EWTN Global Catholic Radio presents John of the Cross, The Great Exchange. Insights into the writings of St. John of the Cross, founder of the Discalced Carmelite Order. Now here is your host, Father Thomas Dubé.
Thank you once again for welcoming us into your home this week. We are dealing in our Great Exchange with the transforming union. But perhaps I had better say again that I am Father Thomas Dubé of the Society of Mary, based in Washington. And we began our transforming union last week with a little caution that it is so sublime that it is very hard for people to believe it could be really what it said, and we say it to be. But there is no exaggeration. Our problem is that our human language cannot really come up to the reality. Eye has not seen nor ear heard, as Paul said, nor can it enter the heart of man what God thinks as has prepared for those who love him, what he's prepared for you and me. Now, the transforming union, let's have a little fast definition of it, is the deepest intimacy with the indwelling Trinity on earth. That's the fullness of the spiritual life, and it brings with it, part of the transformation, heroic virtue. Not only very good, holy living, best kind of human beings we've got are the virtuous ones, of course, but it's heroic, it's miraculous kind of goodness. And we're going to have to touch on that, of course, too. That's briefly what we're dealing with. Now, notice there are two words here, transforming and union. We're going to begin first with the union aspect. And this in one is the harder of the two to grasp. We all know what union is, of course, but there's a sublime section here. And once we're over that one, it's going to be going downhill for ease. It won't be difficult after that. The union between this person and God is now a perfect union. Doesn't make the human being God, of course, but the two wills, God's will and the human will, through the purifications we talked about last week, this person is now completely one with God. Head over heels in love with him. There are no impediments left. There are no selfish clingings left. They have all been purified away. And there's an abiding love for God, which at times, I'm going to use a pedestrian word, spurts into intense experiences of love. But there's always that deep abiding love with God in this person at this time, with those spurts. John uses the expression someplace, if you have a red hot log in a fireplace, you'll notice if you've ever watched them, the red hotness is a continual thing, and then there are spurts of flame that come up. It's like that. That's why he calls one of his works, sublime one, Living Flame of Love. Now, further, in the transforming union, there is a deeper knowledge of God, a kind of perfect knowledge of him. Remember, none of this is to be understood pantheistically. We are not saying the human person becomes God in a literal sense, but the union is so close that, as John says, you can hardly distinguish the two. But they are distinguished. They're not the same. St. Paul speaks of this more times than once, this perfect wisdom. And if we didn't have people like John of the Cross and Teresa, we wouldn't know really what Paul is talking about. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 9, that will explain why, talking about being in love through the Spirit, ever why, since the day he told us, we have never failed to pray for you. And what we ask God is that through perfect wisdom, notice I'm not exaggerating, perfect wisdom and spiritual understanding, you should reach the fullest knowledge of his will. Not a bit of exaggeration here. It's exactly what Paul says, and this is very much what Paul has in mind. Ephesians 1:8 says the same thing. You may look also at Psalm 36, verse 9, in your light we see the light. I wouldn't have a clue as to what that means if I hadn't studied John of the Cross. I just really have no idea what Paul and the psalmist are talking about. Now, thirdly, in the transforming union, we're on the union part now, how close it is, there's a perfect love and an unspeakable delight. And here we take up now what I was telling you about last time, the most difficult thing to explain in our whole series. and I'll do the best I can. And really, it's just gorgeous, the reality, and I don't think you'll have too much trouble with it. I'll try to make it as simple as possible. I'm going to read you a little passage. It's metaphorical language, because poetry is much better than prose to try to express what is inexpressible. Just does the job much better. And I'm going to read you the passage, and unless you've studied John and have had an explanation, you won't know almost anything what he has in mind, what he's talking about. But then we're going to go through the passage, and I'll explain each little bit of it. And it is gorgeous. Here is the passage. God himself is for the soul many lamps together, which illumine and impart warmth to it individually. For it has clear knowledge of each lamp, and through this knowledge is inflamed with love. All these lamps are one lamp, which, according to its powers and attributes, shines and burns like many lamps. Now, if you are completely confused, join the club. Normal. Let's unravel. I shouldn't use the word unravel, I guess. Let's explain what John is saying. A lamp here in this section, I'm just giving you one paragraph. He develops the whole idea at some length. A lamp here is one of the divine attributes. It represents God's power. One lamp is a representation, metaphorically, of the endless power of God. He's pure power. Another lamp is God's pure joy. He's not simply really joyful. He's just absolute, endless joy. Another lamp is his wisdom. Another is his love. Another is his tenderness. Another is his justice. Another is his mercy. The purest perfections of God. And the lamps represent each one of those perfections. Now, each lamp, I'm explaining now the results of being in these lamps, as we'll notice a little further down, each attribute of God thrills the soul, inflames it, and bestows remarkably new knowledge, a keen delight, and a burning love. So that, as John will say, and I'll say it again in a minute or two, the person is in each lamp so that this person is now in just thrilled with the power of God, thrilled with the joy of God, thrilled with the beauty of God, every one of his attributes, you see, and is inflamed in the divine attribute, and has new knowing, and new love, and new delight, and burning with this love. Now, secondly, about this paragraph, John is saying, and he makes the point elsewhere, but it's to be applied here, John is saying that the person is within each of the lamps. Now, that's not the case. We've got some strong lights up here shining on me right now. No one of us ever gets in that light. We don't have that experience on earth. But in this imagery, it's not only a brilliance looking at something outside. The person is within the divine power, in the divine joy, in the divine tenderness, in everything that God is. And all these attributes of God, by the way, are one and the same thing in God. See, we distinguish different attributes because that's our human way of knowing. But in God, these just utterly all of them. And the person is within these lamps, says John, and is enthralled in their beauty. Next little point. Now, we're over the most difficult part, by the way. I think I've covered everything here that I want to, that each lamp, individual perfection, individual attribute of God, I'm just checking to be sure I've said everything. Oh, yes. And when John says in that little paragraph that all these lamps are one lamp, it's what I just said a minute ago, that God's power is his mercy is his justice, is his tenderness, is his wisdom, is his love, is his beauty. Everything is one in God. He's utterly simple. No parts to him at all. If there were parts in God, he wouldn't be God. Absolute perfection. Now, we're over the hardest part of this whole transforming union. The rest is rather easy. But we're still on the union part. there is in this experience of the Trinity indwelling a spiritual embrace, a hug. You might say, all the hugs we know about are physical. With your arms, you embrace another person. That's right. But there is such a thing as a spiritual embrace. People like John and Teresa and Thomas Aquinas, sober Thomas, sober, I mean, a brilliant mind and so solid and just an intellectual genius. He talks about it too. There is a spiritual hug. They agree about that. And what might surprise you about this, further surprise, is that it can get so tight, so strong an embrace, that the person could not sustain it and remain alive, except God gives a special strength to do it. It's that strong an embrace. So if you ever want to be hugged super duper, grow in prayer. That's part of the package when you get to the summit of it. Further in this union, there is a divine tenderness, naturally, unlimited tenderness. The way God loves you and me, there's no end to it, you see. And His tenderness with us, and a wanting to forgive and not forcing anybody's will. If I want to reject God, He'll let me reject Him. Because He gave us free will, and we're going to do with our destiny whatever we choose to do. But He loves most tenderly. Now, I want to cite to you a little paragraph from John, because it's rare in John that he exclaims. He's also very sober, trying to express the inexpressible. He's very, sober is a good word, that he doesn't overstate things. I want to share you this little paragraph with you, this little paragraph where John just bursts out into an exclamation, very much unlike him, in his writing at least. And here is what he says. I cite it not simply to illustrate an exclamation in John, but for the idea also. In this union, the tenderness and truth of love by which the immense Father favors and exalts this humble and loving soul reaches such a degree, and here's his exclamation, O wonderful thing, worthy of all our awe and admiration. It reaches such a degree that the Father Himself becomes subject to her, the soul, for her exaltation, as though He were the servant and she His Lord. And He is as solicitous in favoring her as He would be if He were her slave and she His God. That's just extraordinary. Now, we're finished with the union. We take up next the transforming aspect of this summit of the human person's immersion in God. And once again, I'd like to caution, as I did at the end of last week's program, don't give in to the temptation to think that things are being exaggerated here, because they're not. If anything, they are understatements. And John makes that point in his works. That's why he sometimes will say, I prefer to just be silent about this, because you will think that what I said is adequate explanation of it. And it's not adequate. So there's no exaggeration going on here. What is this transformation like? St. Paul himself, by the way, speaks of the transformation, and he's aware, clearly aware, of the problem that we face here. Let me remind all of us of that text that we had several episodes ago. In 2 Corinthians 3:18, says Paul, we, with our unveiled faces, reflecting like mirrors the brightness of the Lord, are transformed from one glory to another as we are turned into the image that we reflect. So Paul speaks of a transformation from one glory to another. We're going to look now at what those transformations are like. I have 7 of them that we will speak about. And the first one is that there's a continual awareness of the Lord indwelling. I like to call it dual awareness, meaning that the person in the transforming union, which lasts through the day, it's not only at prayer time, attends completely to the task of the day. So if you're conversing with a person at this summit, you will converse in a perfectly normal manner, and the person will hear everything you say, or if it's a bookkeeper, will keep the books correctly, or cook the meal correctly, or teach a class correctly. Aware of what's being done on the human level, but also abidingly aware of a deep level sensitivity. I'm struggling for a word. It's not a sensitivity in a sense. But it's an awareness of God in the deep center of one's being. An unspeakable kind of awareness, and it's dual. Therefore, the person attends to you and me completely, normally, but is also aware of God inside. St. Peter speaks of a joy beyond understanding in 1 Peter 1:8. This would fit that very well indeed. The next transformation or aspect of the transformation, because they all make one reality, of course. The next one, number two, everything that we do in daily life, and indeed everything we suffer, becomes love. Before we develop that, let me just remind ourselves of the second letter of John in the New Testament. This is not John of the Cross, this is John the Evangelist. He speaks of that idea, and John develops it beautifully. In the second letter of John, verse 6, only one chapter in that letter. To love is to live according to his commandments. This is the commandment which you have heard since the beginning, to live a life of love. Now, what would that mean? If we didn't have John of the Cross, I would have to struggle to say what that means. I would have said, well, keep all the commandments and you're loving when you do that. True enough, and that certainly is part of the meaning here. But John is saying that for the person in the transforming union, to scrub the floor is a loving thing. To be insulted is a loving thing. I remember St. Francis of Assisi, who certainly reached this stage of prayer life. He was excluded from one of his own houses, the founder of the Franciscan order. In a rainstorm, he came in, and for some reason, I don't know what was wrong with the person at the door, they excluded him. And I think they knew who he was, too. And John said, this is perfect joy, because he can unite with the Lord on the cross, with whom he's, I was going to say, desperately in love, head over heels in love. And so even to be treated rudely, to be abused, if you've ever suffered a verbal abuse, you know what I'm talking about. That becomes an act of love. So doing menial work is love. Doing joyful work, teaching a class, listening to a class, being bored by somebody. But the thing about people in the transforming union, they're not bored. So that would have been a mistake to say that, but I was trying to get over an idea, you see. So I think we can leave it as it is. You know what I'm driving at. Everything becomes love, whether it's painful or delightful. Third aspect of the transforming union, there's a cessation of interior sufferings. This person can suffer from illnesses and pain. St. Francis of Assisi, on his deathbed, was in agony, but also he was just bursting with joy. At the same time, the two things can happen together. They do happen together in a person at this stage of prayer. So external sufferings don't cease, and the person really hurts in different ways, whether it's illness or mistreatment from some other person. But nonetheless, interior sufferings are gone. And it makes complete sense. Once you grant what we've been saying about the union and the immense closeness of it, well, all of this certainly makes sense. It just follows with complete logic and consistency. So that because there's nothing to be purified inside the human person, then there's no need to suffer the purifications. That's why the two nights are gone. They're in the past now. And all the difficulties of them, they're gone. Interior sufferings cease because there is no selfishness now that has to be eradicated. There's no sin in this person to cause pain. Now let me just qualify that a little bit, because I'm not going to take it up elsewhere, so I better say it here. I'm not saying that the person in the transforming union couldn't sin. John makes the point that this person could not sin mortally and lose the state of grace. The union is so close. Teresa has another view about that. But in any event, the person could slip into a little momentary weakness at some point or other, but I would hardly expect a deliberate venial sin in this person, if that ever does occur, you see. So that has to be borne in mind too. So when I say that there's no selfishness and no sin to be purified, I don't mean to exclude a little bit of a weakness lap or half advertence or something of the sort that can occur in this person. So there's no interior suffering because there's no reason to suffer interiorly. There's nothing habitually amiss in this individual. The fourth trait of this person, imperfections cease. By imperfections here, I mean not simply sins. Sins are sins. I mean by imperfections here, things of which we're not guilty really, because there's no adequate reflection of our intellect and there's consequently no freedom, no moral awareness. Those little things are mistakes, things that we don't knowingly will to do. But imperfections, even when there's no guilt in the thing, they also tend very much to cease in the transforming union. And we mean, for example, mere tendencies, disordered tendencies toward anger, for instance, impatience, or a tendency to be careless with the truth. Those tendencies are what we're calling here imperfections. Even when the person doesn't will anything, impatient or untruthful, the tendency is there in lesser degrees of development in the spiritual life. But in the transforming union, the tendency is gone. So that this person is very much living what St. Paul of the Cross says in 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether you eat or drink or do anything else at all, do all for the glory of God. Everything. And that verse is lived just gorgeously by the person in the transforming union. The fifth particular trait, aspect of the transforming union. This is a little bit tricky to get over, but not really that difficult with an example or two. Our very first inclinations before our intellect is aware of what's going on, before there's a moral dimension awareness, before our will enters in, this person is inclined toward God immediately. Now, in the Latin, and people of my generation studied theology in Latin very much, we used to have a very neat little expression. I don't know if I should mention it here. I will. There might be some people who know Latin. They would enjoy it. It says the thing perfectly, and I have to struggle to put it in English. And the English is not elegant. In Latin, we spoke of those first inclinations in an individual which do not have a moral dimension because there's not awareness of the moral aspect of it, and there's no free will. But it's a movement, inclination inside. And we call those things motus primo primi. Motus means the inclination, the movement. Primo is an adverb. And primi, agreeing with motus, means first. So primo means first, and primi means first. So the best literal translation I can give of that in English, and it brings the point out so well, though the English is not elegant. Movements that are firstly first. What that means is, and just a reflection on your own experience of your own self, you know that they are there. These movements, firstly first movements or inclinations, are those reactions that you and I have to things that happen before we advert to a moral dimension in them. Therefore, there's no guilt if we do something wrong at that stage. For instance, suppose somebody had a strange sense of humor and jumped on your toes. Most of us would be much upset that somebody had that kind of goofy idea of being funny. And our first movement would be anger for most of us. But there's no guilt in it because you can't help feeling angry when somebody jumps on your toes for the fun of it. that first movement is without advertence to a moral dimension. There's no freedom in that first anger. Now, for a person in the transforming union, the first inclination there would be compassion toward the person. It's an inclination toward God and being like God. And the first movement for this person would be a compassion for somebody with so odd an idea about humor. And so also, to illustrate the point, suppose you have a teacher in class and the kids in the classroom are fooling around and a gentle correction has been given, but this little guy here, Billy or whoever it is still fooling around. This teacher quite surely is going to experience movements of impatience. See? Okay. Now, the first movement of impatience without advertence to any moral dimension, no guilt, because there's no sin. A person in the transforming union will have a godly kind, a very holy kind of reaction toward this youngster fooling around in the classroom. And so at this stage of prayer development, one's interior life is now so peaceful, so ideal, so perfect, that the first spontaneous motions are God-directed. We'll have to leave off for there now and take up with these traits next week. Thank you.
Join us again next week at this time for John of the Cross, The Great Exchange, on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio.